Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and really glad to be with you today. We have a very exciting edition of the show. You know, and I was thinking about this, I recently read Bob Avakian's book, Basics, and the first quote that opens that book up says, "There would be no United States as we know it today without slavery. This is a simple and basic truth." A simple and basic truth, but it's a truth that really I think a whole lot of people don't really get as deep as we should. And part of the reason is that there's a lot of cover-up, a lot of hiding, and also a huge cover-up of the true history of this country and the foundational role of slavery in this country from the very beginning. But let's be clear about this, because it's not all in the past. In fact, if you've been at all awake over these last couple of weeks, if you have any amount of sense about what the hell is going on in society, in 4 days, there were three outrages that should have made you stand up and say, wait a minute, what is happening here? Something's really got to change here. Three outrages in 4 days in America, okay? And let's just like get that America, okay? A few three Ks up in there. Think about this. The Supreme Court comes out with an anti-affirmative action decision, basically saying that, you know, well that affirmative action stuff, let's put that on the back burner. Let's remove it from the stove altogether, okay? And then you have a fascist mob that's forming up around that, just that insane, backward, racist rancher, Cliven Bundy, who's saying, you know, look, black people didn't really appreciate slavery. They actually had it pretty well off under slavery. And then you get the racist rants by, it makes me feel just dirty to even say his name, Donald Sterling, the owner of the LA Clippers. And anybody who heard what Sterling had to say, you undoubtedly had to rush into the shower too. And believe me, I know it takes weeks to try and get that scum off of your skin and out of your mind, all right? So you think about this. This is what we're talking about, and this is testimony to the fact that the foundation of this system remains slavery and the continuing severe oppression of black people in America. So this week, we're going to have a special show focused up around all of this. And it's a show that brings together some segments that we did previously. But as I was thinking about things this week, I kept thinking, we need to focus on this. So at the back end of the show, we'll be listening to an excerpt from a talk by Bob Avakian on communism and Jeffersonian democracy. And in particular, this excerpt is titled Jefferson's Ideal of a Good and Just Society and the Reality of Slavery. But first up, and keeping to this theme, we're going to be talking with Dan Rasmussen, the author of American Uprising, The Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt. This is a book that punches right through that whole terrible atmosphere of repression and suppression. It's a book that dares to tell the truth in the face of some of the most sacred lies and legends of this country's history. And I'm telling you, this is a very, very cool book. It's written by a cat that was 23 years old when he wrote it. He was going to Harvard. He heard stories about a slave rebellion in New Orleans. He said that he was intrigued by it. He wanted to find out more about it, but he couldn't find anything out. And he dedicated a good part of his time in college to actually figuring this out. Developed the whole thing, developed this book that is now a New York Times bestseller. But frankly, a lot of people that I talk to don't even know about it. So we're going to open up our show with a conversation I had with Dan a few days ago about his book. Let's take a listen. You know, I read a lot of books, and it's rare that I get the opportunity to say that one book in particular was one that grabbed me from the very beginning that I literally could not put down. I felt a tremendous compulsion to just read the book all the way through and then to reread it. I was just so impressed with what was in the book and with the importance of the book. And that book is American Uprising, The Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt. And the book is by Daniel Rasmussen, and I'm really happy to welcome Daniel to the show today. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here, and thank you for those wonderful comments about the book.
Well, I'll tell you, it really is true. It's one of those things where one of the few books in the last few years that I've actually picked up and said, as I started to read it, got halfway into it and realized I'm holding something extremely important, not just for understanding the past, but also for understanding what the future can hold and what's going on today. So it's really remarkable. A lot to learn in it. So
thank you.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. First off, why don't we tell people what the rebellion was, this largest slave rebellion? Why don't we tell it what it was? You know, you describe in the book the rebellion as the largest act of armed resistance against slavery in the history of the U.S. Can you tell people what you're talking about here?
Absolutely. You know, this is a revolt that began in New Orleans in 1811. And New Orleans at this time is this wild frontier area It's on the fringes of America. It's on the Gulf Coast. It's closer culturally to Spain or France or the Caribbean than it is to Virginia or Tennessee. And in Louisiana, they are growing sugar along the Mississippi River. Sugar is not really grown in many other places in the United States. It's primarily grown in other places like Haiti and Jamaica and Brazil. It's an incredibly brutal form of slavery. When slaves talked about being sold south or sold down the river, they meant Louisiana. Average lifespan of a slave sold into sugar slavery in Louisiana is about 7 years. Brutal violence, whipping, torture devices, etc., were used to keep these slaves in check. And because it's early here in 1811, there are lots of slaves newly brought over from Africa, from the Ashanti Kingdom in West Africa, refugees from Haiti, slaves who had been in Haiti during the revolution there. And in 1811, as America is fighting with the Spanish to take over West Florida, which is present-day Alabama, slaves in these plantations form basically a large conspiracy. There are 11 separate leaders, three of whom are perhaps most prominent, a slave driver named Charles de Lande, and then two Ashanti warriors, Kuk and Kumana. And they lead an insurrection of somewhere between, eyewitness accounts vary, but between 200 and 500 slaves who march in military uniform, flying flags, beating drums, with officers wearing military uniforms with epaulettes at their front of each unit, chanting on to New Orleans and freedom or death. And they come within 15 miles of conquering New Orleans, and their goal being to establish a black republic a la Haiti there on the shores of the Mississippi River.
All right, well, let me ask you this, because you also you define this, or you say that this rebellion was actually a defining moment in the history of both New Orleans and the U.S. itself. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. Now, New Orleans, I was mentioning, is sort of this frontier territory, and you've got these French and Spanish planters there who are 80% French and Spanish. And New Orleans, they've been resistant to American authority. And what happens is this revolt forces them into the hands of the American government. After the revolt, despite their resistance to American authority prior to it, the House of Representatives, the Speaker, gets up and he says, "We shall cling to the United States as an ark of safety." And what he means, there's no debate here in New Orleans after the revolt about whether perhaps they should stop slavery or stop slave importation. The thing that changes after this revolt is that they ask for greater integration into the United States, for more federal military troops to be stationed in New Orleans. That's why in the War of 1812, Louisiana is the only place where the Americans beat the British, because it's a heavily militarized area to protect the planters from their own slaves. You see a solidification of this alliance between the federal government and slaveholders in the Deep South that basically paves the way for the Southwestern expansion that would ultimately lead to the Civil War. Without the suppression of this revolt, without the alliance that revolt crystallized between the planters and the federal government. Now, the federal government played a role in suppressing the revolt and defeating the slaves. You don't have that larger pattern, that larger trend.
We're talking with Daniel Rasmussen, the author of American Uprising, The Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt. Now, Dan, you know, one of the things that really struck me very early on in reading your book was that, you know, it's something that for me and for many people who are agonizing over the state of the world and the need for change, in particular fundamental change, revolutionary change, there's always the idea that this just isn't possible. You come up against that all the time. But the story you tell reveals how things can actually come together to open up a possibility for an attempt at revolutionary change in ways completely unexpected. Here they were in the midst of the situation that you're describing, the terrible barbarity and the work that you would be worked to death on. And yet things came together in a really totally unexpected way to open up a door of possibility here. Can you talk about some of these various factors? For instance, you say that the German coast was ripe for this revolt. Why?
It was. There are really three reasons why the slaves think that they can achieve this sort of revolutionary overthrow of the American government. And the first is that I think we think, well, how in the world could slaves think that they could defeat a major European power? How in the world could they think that they, you know, this bunch of ragtag people under oppression in chains could rise up and accomplish that? And the reason that they believe that they can is because it happened. It happened just a few years before in Haiti, an island just a few hundred miles off the coast of New Orleans with very close ties to Louisiana because they were both French colonies. And what happens there is that in 1791, slaves rise up and they defeat the armies of Napoleon Bonaparte, the great warlord of Europe. They defeat his armies, kill 70,000 of his troops in 1804, declare independence. They abolish slavery, declare racism illegal, and formally ban any Frenchman from dirtying with his sacrilegious foot the land of liberty. That's a quote from the Declaration of Independence of Haiti. And so because there's those cultural similarities, in fact, many slaves then would come over from Haiti as refugees with their masters to Louisiana. There's this sense of revolution. There's this beacon of hope. And there's this belief among the slave populations throughout the New World that Haiti, they've seen that inspiration. They believe they, too, can win. They, too, can beat European militaries. And the second reason, you know, you see almost all slave revolts taking place at a time when white powers are divided, when the masters are at war. And that's exactly what's taking place here in New Orleans. In 1810, the United States government is fighting a war with the Spanish for Baton Rouge and West Florida, which is present-day Alabama. They've sent the best American troops, the Dragoons, out of New Orleans, leaving the city basically defenseless, and there are rumors that the Spanish are going to launch a counterattack from Cuba. In addition, you have the War of 1812 looming on the horizon with war with Britain, and so you have these slaves taking advantage of these geopolitical trends, taking advantage of this moment of conflict, and launching a revolt at a precise time when they are aware that the Americans are weakened, that they're at war, they're distracted, and that there might be the possibility of Spanish or British intervention in the region. And the third reason is that New Orleans was, as it is now, a bit of a party town. And after the finish of harvest in December, they devoted January, starting on Epiphany Sunday, January 6th, and leading up to Mardi Gras, to parties. So if you read the newspapers in that period, they're full of, the planters aren't focused on the sort of looming slave revolt or the conspiracy in the quarters. They're totally unaware of that. They're focused on parties, you know, which hairdresser is in fashion, which dancing master from Paris is in Louisiana that season, and, you know, what's going to be served at the big balls that take place throughout the city during January.
You know, there's a couple of other things that you mentioned that I found really to be unexpected, and things you just wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't ever chalk up to playing a critical role in actually opening the store of possibility. One was this weird kind of culture that seemed to exist in New Orleans and Louisiana around that in the midst of these very barbaric conditions, which the sugar plantation work was like, seems to be among the most horrendous, you know, work that slaves were actually forced to do in the entire country. And in the midst of that, there was a certain amount of sort of social life that enslaved people were allowed to engage in, mixing, traveling, things that, you know, the dances that you described, the weekly dances or whatever. And it sort of generated or gave the basis for or cover for a tremendous amount of communication and talking and comparison and maybe even discussing things like at one point, I know you said that they found political tracts in some of the slave quarters, like the stuff from Haiti or the French Revolution, that these documents that people were actually looking at and had this kind of influence that you're talking about in geopolitical terms. But there was this weird kind of culture that seemed to function in New Orleans at the same time that allowed the slaves a certain amount of freedom to plot and plan.
Yeah, you know, I think that speaks to I think an important misconception about slavery is when we think about slavery, I think we often think of it as rural. We think of the slaves as isolated. And we think of these plantations as sort of these autonomous units. But in reality, throughout the South, and this is not unique to New Orleans, there's a tremendous amount of communication among these slaves population. So, you know, just to think about it, how that communication is happening. You know, who are the coach drivers? Who are the messenger boys? Who is delivering the produce to market? Who is meeting with the other slave leaders to plot crop cycles? There's a tremendous amount of shared information. And if you fast forward through that, there's also black sailors. You know, many of the sailors in these ships are African American. So there is a tremendous network of information moving around the South, moving up and down the rivers, moving to the marketplaces, moving through the plantations. And so there's this flow of information. And what makes New Orleans special is that because of the French and Spanish heritage, there are actually these big dances that are allowed to take place in the city in the Congo Square. You can still go to Congo Square in New Orleans. And those dances were actually breeding grounds for slave conspiracy. In fact, in one Congolese dialect, the word for to dance is synonymous with the phrase to declare war.
That's interesting. And that actually brings me to the next really unexpected thing I found, which was, and I shouldn't have been so surprised by it, but when you talk about the slaves who were captured and brought to this country, you actually present a picture of a very complex humanity with a lot of experiences in their own life and their thinking and in their, even in what they did when they were in their home countries. And one of the things you talk about is that in the holds of these slave ships, you oftentimes had people who themselves were military leaders, had been engaged in warfare, had some understanding of, you know, people can stand up, rebel, and win, and an understanding of military tactics.
Absolutely. So West Africa is being torn apart by war, and that war is fueled by European powers who arm one tribe and then have that tribe go and conquer other tribes and then sell their enemies into slavery. And so there are West African tribes and nations who are armed with muskets, the same weapons you're seeing fought in European wars, who are trained sometimes by colonial forces or are experienced with guerrilla warfare. And these are the type of people that are being then sold into slavery. And if you think about Louisiana as being sort of an outskirt of the major hubs of the slave trade, which are Jamaica, Brazil, et cetera, then you think that sort of the worst slaves, the ones that the people don't want to buy in Jamaica, that don't want to buy in Brazil, then are being passed off to Charleston, to Louisiana. And so you're getting actually a fairly high concentration of slaves that had been from these war-torn areas, people who had fought in wars, people who would have been trained from birth how to fight, familiar with muskets, familiar with tactics. And so there's a, you know, in some ways, a tremendous stupidity to what these guys are doing. In their desperation to build up the slave economy on the shores of the Mississippi River, they're bringing in these sort of hardened warriors, these guys who are not willing to submit to the system of slavery and who really are going to fight to the death to be free. And that's why you see two of the major leaders of this revolt are from the same kingdom, the Ashanti Kingdom in West Africa. And those guys are dangerous men.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're talking today with Dan Rasmussen, the author of American Uprising, The Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt, a really important book. Everyone out there listening should run out and pick this up and read it tonight when you hear this. Now, Dan, one of the things I wanted to ask you is that there's a point here that you seem to keep coming back to in the story, and that is the critical need for leadership in this kind of rebellion. Can you talk about that? Because there did emerge a sort of a leadership, a radical core among the slaves that made this, that actually helped make this thing possible.
Yeah. Well, I think the most fascinating character is this guy named Charles de Lande. I've talked about Cook and Kumana, but Charles, I think, is particularly interesting for sort of his insights into the psychology of the slave quarters. And Charles is interesting because he is the son of a white slave owner and an enslaved mother in what was unlikely to have been a consensual relationship. And Charles, because of his light skin, like many light-skinned slaves in Louisiana, was given special privileges by virtue of his skin color. He was appointed to be a slave driver, the top of the slave hierarchy. On a plantation, there's the master, the overseer, the driver, and then all of the other slaves. And the driver is responsible for organizing the work of the other slaves, for punishing those that act out or misbehave, for meeting with the master every morning to discuss the work plan for that day. He is really the right-hand man of the master. And in exchange for those for that work, for you know, sort of working on the side of the master against his fellow slaves, a driver like Charles would have been given special privileges, a nicer cabin, better clothes, the freedom to travel, to have a wife. And so Charles, men like Charles would have been considered by other slaves sort of the ultimate betrayers of the race, men who are really selling out their fellows in exchange for privilege, for luxury. And yet Charles, well, you know, reviled by his fellow slaves, well, seen by the master as this trustworthy character, is secretly using his status to undermine the system, to plot with his fellow slaves, to sow the seeds of insurrection. And as he travels up and down the coast, ostensibly to see his wife, to meet with other slaves, slave leaders, slave drivers, to discuss the crop cycle, he's actually meeting with Cook and Kumana, with these Akan warriors. He's meeting with this guy, Harry Kenner, who's another, an American, Anglo-American slave. And they're meeting together in taverns on the levee. They're meeting together in the cypress swamps. They're meeting on the roads. And they are talking about plotting and laying the seeds for a revolt that would have 11 insurrectionary cells up and down the coast, and that had as its goal to overthrow the city of New Orleans.
Among these leaders, did you see anything in common in terms of, you know, because I'm trying to figure out, too, again, how key was this question of leadership? Because oftentimes what we hear when you talk about slave rebellions, there's occasionally a Nat Turner, there's, you know, different slaves who rise to lead a rebellion. But generally, the rebellions are always presented as sort of a mass uprising, which they do have that character. But it actually seems, and what you document, is the role of leadership seems to have been a very key factor in actually even being able to carry this thing out. You're describing some of the ways that they did it, but even in the course of carrying the rebellion out, the kind of tactical decisions or the understanding of what you needed to do to advance the struggle. I mean, you make a point that they were in completely uncharted waters at the time of the rebellion, and they had to actually make some very, very quick and important decisions in the course of all this.
That's absolutely right. Leadership is essential to this rebellion. I think there are really two ways in which I think it's important to think about the role of leadership in this revolt. And the first is that many of these slaves who lead the revolt are already leading slaves, right? Charles de Lon is a slave driver. His job is to run a plantation of 40 slaves. He is a man who has sophisticated management skills, who has training, and who has already, you know, this long track record of commanding and controlling his fellow slaves. And he's working with other slave leaders who have had similar experiences, as well as people who are from Africa and have had leadership experiences there. And so they're drawing on experience. They're not sort of taking the reins without any sort of practice. And second, I think you see in this revolt is distinct from other major revolts, right? We think of Nat Turner, Denmark Vesey, or even John Brown. You think of one man sort of taking over, being the leader, the voice of authority. But here, you see really a council of leaders, men who are representing their own plantations, their own ethnic groups, and who are coming together across ethnic lines, across religious lines, across linguistic lines, to meet together, to plot together. And this is a political revolution. It's not, we don't see much, there's no mention of a religious undertone. There's no sort of, it's really a sophisticated political, process. And I think that it's important. I think one of the reasons I feel so strongly that the story needs to be told is because I think it challenges those stereotypes that we have of slaves as sort of rudderless, of them as sort of obedient to their masters, or as simple victims, constant victims of slave authority without, ever resisting. But here you see slaves as sophisticated, as deeply political, as working with each other and with leaders to come to real political solutions, political answers that are revolutionary, and revolutionary in that they declare that these men are no longer slaves, that they are free, and not only are they free, but they're free men who deserve an independent political existence, a Republican political existence that is challenging the very essence of slave society.
We're talking with Daniel Rasmussen, the author of American Uprising, The Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt. And let's talk about this a little bit more, because I'm really fascinated by this idea of the ideological and political components of this rebellion. And you actually make that point a number of times in the book in terms of really arguing for people to understand the sophistication of the slave leadership, but also of the rebellion itself, and that it was not, as it was later characterized, a criminal rampage or something that was just a band of slaves out to just raise a lot of hell and get some revenge. But there was actually, these people had a very set goal. They had a desire to get out from under this, and they had a politics and an ideology that they adhered to. And can you talk a little bit about what that was? Because it's rare to hear people talk about a slave rebellion as being ideological and political.
Absolutely. There is a sophisticated political ideology, an undercurrent of resistance that is emanating and spreading throughout the New World at this time, and especially in the Caribbean. It sort of has its start in sort of the 1740s and 1750s, has its culmination in Haiti. But really Haiti, there's before Haiti and there's after Haiti. And all these slaves are thinking about, or not all they're thinking about, one of the most important things they're thinking about is the template of Haiti, the template of black armies overthrowing European powers, declaring independence, and establishing a republic that abolishes slavery and declares racism illegal. That's the philosophy of radical black republicanism. And that is a philosophy which is a beacon of hope to slaves throughout the New World. And that ideology actually importantly influenced the French Revolution, the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the People in France. Many of the same people who are involved in France in understanding and aiding those Haitian revolutionaries are the same people that are the most radical Republicans in France. And so you actually see, as you mentioned earlier, there are French democratic tracks discovered in the slave quarters. There are agents who are arrested and thrown in jail for provoking and spreading radical Republican ideology in the slave quarters. I think that there's the most important place to see that is in the slaves' decision. And these rebels' decision to put on military uniforms, to fly flags, to march in formation. And those gestures, those concrete actions, are symbolic. They're deeply symbolic. They're symbolic of a declaration of a people who have been declared little better than animals, who are saying, by putting on these military uniforms, by flying these flags, we are asserting not only our humanity, but our political situation, our political stature. And that's a statement which is, I think, remarkable for its bravery and remarkable for its sophistication.
Now let's talk about the response of the rulers in the region to this rebellion, because the rebellion was eventually defeated, and that doesn't take away at all from the significance of this rebellion. And in fact, the response of the rulers kind of gives a hint at how significant it actually was. So can you tell people, what was the response of the planners and the ruling class in the area to this rebellion?
Unspeakable brutality. As soon as they defeat the slaves in a massive battle on the cane fields, they hunt them down, they behead them, they dismember their corpses, and they dangle their corpses from they take poles, they put the heads on poles, and they put those poles along the levee for 40 miles from the center of New Orleans out into the sugar country. So for 40 miles, you see heads on pikes, up to 100 of them. And that is just a tremendous statement about how afraid these planters are and about the extent to which they will go to make sure that this revolt is suppressed. 100 heads on pikes, one of the greatest massacres in American history. Next thing they do, they try to write it out of history.
I wanted to ask you this. They did have, in addition to the kind of response they had, the brutal response, the tremendous brutality of that response, they also did things like these show trials, apparently, that was really struck me as they, you know, the way that they actually pumped this up and fashioned a story. On one hand, they immediately had to speak to it. On the other hand, the description they had of it was all geared towards eventually writing it out of history.
Exactly. So they take a set portion, about 30 slaves, and they put them on trial. And these court trials that take place in the D'Estrehan Plantation and in the Cabildo in central New Orleans are not necessarily meant to, the way legal trials are today, to sort of determine what happened, to establish the facts, to declare guilt and innocence. They're meant really as symbolic actions to say, we, who have just committed these unspeakable brutalities, are on the side of civilization. Civilization is on our side. The law is on our side. And these rebels, these slaves, they're not revolutionaries. They're mere criminals. And so they actually, the trials are just meant to give sort of a gloss of legality and civilization to the brutality that's going on. And you'll see that right after the trials, the exact same thing happens. They behead the slaves. They put their heads on pikes. They put their dismembered corpses in the gates of New Orleans. Right, the exact same things that happened before the trials happen after the trials. The only point is to give this gloss of legality, to strip the slaves of any sort of political message, and to dismiss them as criminals.
Let me ask you this then, because the impact of this, I mean, they clearly had, I'm sure it had an impact of terrorizing the local population of the enslaved people. At the same time, it seemed to have impact on a number of different fronts. You know, one of the things that really struck me was that you talked earlier about the use of this rebellion and the response to it in the solidification of the Louisiana area, of New Orleans, of all that, and the U.S. empire in that part of the world. And it seemed to, as you speak to in the book, it seems to actually have carried on through the rampages of Andrew Jackson and the slaughter of native peoples. And there was one fort you talked about that had been used as for free slaves, escaped slaves, and they established something there. I think it was under Spanish domination at that time, and then when Spanish left. This sort of rebellion seemed to have an impact that carried on way beyond the rebellion itself and the immediate aftermath of the rebellion, to the whole way that the society and the continuation of slavery in that part of the country and was hammered down.
Yeah, this is this great sort of stand against slavery, against imperialism. And after it's crushed, I think that the planters and the federal government and the federal military have learned their lesson. And they know that what they need to do is make it absolutely clear that they will not brook any resistance from their enslaved people, and that they will unrelentingly hunt down and ensure that anyone who provokes slave revolt in any way is killed and eliminated. And one of the main forces, really, they're worried about is the Spanish, who control lots of land, and the Native Americans, who control lots of land. Because if there are places where slaves can escape to, if they feel that they can have support from these other powers, then that land is not safe for slavery. So in order to make the land safe for slavery, in order to protect the planters from their own slaves, they have to relentlessly eliminate Native American tribes, relentlessly eliminate any sort of Spanish threat, and establish real military dominance over the Southwest. And that's a story which really leads up to 1860 very well.
And also, I was surprised to find out the tremendous impact it had, even in relation to the War of 1812, where the idea that the British had, for instance, had black battalions or something, black, you know, squads that were out there, companies that were out there, and the idea that there was a chance that this might reignite whatever embers were still glowing from the rebellion.
Absolutely. They're terrified that the British are going to use black troops. The British use the threat of black troops as a way of terrorizing the American colonists. Because they know that there's really nothing that they fear more than slave insurrection.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're talking today with Dan Rasmussen, the author of American Uprising, The Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt. Now, let's talk about this, the cover-up, because this is something, and it's really amazing. I think everyone I've shown the book to, talked to about the book, people in general, I think, have no idea about this rebellion ever happening, let alone its significance. They just have no idea. It's been sort of written out of history almost completely.
Yep, this is the bicentennial of the revolt. It happened in 1811. Today is 2011. And yet you browse through textbooks, history textbooks, you don't find mention of this revolt. You can graduate from college. You know Nat Turner, John Brown, those are household names. But nobody's ever heard of Charles de Lande or Cook or Quamana. And that's really why I wrote this book, to change that. I want to make sure that this revolt is in every textbook. I want to make sure that everybody knows the names of the leaders of this revolt, and that the story of these men who fought and died for freedom, who are martyrs for liberty, will go down in history alongside Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, and that we'll understand there's more complexity to our American past. It's not just a simple story about the triumph of freedom and liberty, but that slavery is an essential part of that story, and that we have to understand the compromises and the evil, in some cases, behind what was going on in some places in the South in the antebellum period, and the way in which the nation was complicit, even actively promoting those systems.
Well, it really does. Your book really does give you a sense of how thoroughly this country, this system that's in this country, is rooted in and based on slavery, and has continued, that legacy has continued to play a role up to this day. I mean, you look at the mass incarceration, Michelle Alexander's book on the mass incarceration and the new Jim Crow system that's being created out of this, or with Douglas Blackman's book, Slavery by Another Name. This kind of thing has continued to play out all through it. And you really get a sense of that this country, without slavery, this country would be an entirely different place. It might not even be this country in the way you look at it today. But for it to be this country, it needed slavery. And it continues to exercise sort of an influence up to the present day.
There's no doubt. And I think one statistic that I love to throw out, because it really shocks people, is that the majority of U.S. exports from 1800 to 1935 was cotton, right? The majority of U.S. exports, the main driver of the American economy from 1800 to 1935 was cotton. That cotton was produced by slaves from 1800 to 1860, and that cotton was produced by people who lived in almost slavery from then on, you know, well into the 30s and even later, enforced by Jim Crow. And so you see slavery as really the underpinnings of American economic growth, and that's not just in the South, that's national. Right. You know, you go to Massachusetts, where I live, right, and you look at the economic growth that occurred here, you know, spurred on by textile mills and by shipping. And you ask yourself, well, what exactly were the textiles making? Well, they were taking cotton and turning it into clothes. Well, what were they shipping? They were shipping cotton, and they were shipping sugar, and they were shipping slaves. And so you cannot separate the story of slavery from the story of the development of the American nation, because it is absolutely essential and inextricable from the growth and development of this country.
All right, two more questions. It was a massive cover-up. It continued way up into the, you know, modern times. How did you discover it, and what did you have to do to actually be able to go in and tell the story as powerfully as you have?
You know, well, you know, it was covered up, you know, from about 1860. It was acknowledged that this had happened. You know, it's well known in New Orleans by historians that this had happened. But it's fallen prey to sort of the politics of history, that really you had white supremacists writing history up until about 1945, writing American history. When they described this revolt, they described it as an example of, one of the historians says, why we should hold the reins tight around the blacks. And so that's the perspective at which it's being written. In 1945, there's a scholar called named Herbert Aptheker, who writes an amazing book called American Negro Slave Revolt, and he's the first to identify this as the largest slave revolt in American history. But unfortunately, almost nobody is able to figure out what actually happened, because the primary sources, the newspapers and the letters that are written by William Claiborne, the governor, and the planters, are very dismissive of the event. They call them the slaves a bunch of brigands. They say it was brief, that nothing really happened, don't pay any attention. And so historians really, since Aptheker, have acknowledged this as the largest slave revolt without really able to piece together what actually happened. And so what I had to do is go to the next level of sources, to military records, to ambassadorial correspondence, to the financial statements of the planters, and I built databases with the name of every single slave that participated, because the only way to tell the story is from the perspective of the slaves who were the main actors, who initiated this, and whose idea this revolt was. And so I built a database with all the information about each individual participant. I mapped those databases on old land maps, and then I used Google Maps and other technology to figure out, if we know from the military records that at 2 a.m. they encountered the slave army at location X, then you can use Google Maps to say, well, it would have been 3 hours before that this event happened at location Y. And after I'd used that database and those maps to build out that chronological and spatial understanding, I used all sorts of secondary source accounts, travelers' narratives, newspaper accounts, anything I could find to build a picture, to build out a story, to tell the story from the perspective of the slaves, and to make it come alive, to make the setting come alive. To make the battles come alive, and to make the world of New Orleans, which is so foreign to our eyes, come alive for the reader.
Now, was there anything in your research that you found that was like really shocking or especially surprising to you? I mean, given that this was an untold story by and large, and what you went into this knowing had to be very limited, was there anything you discovered that really just shocked the hell out of you?
Absolutely. You know, the most shocking thing was when I was in the archives and I was looking through military records, because I was desperate to find, I think the question that I really was at the back of my head was, did the slaves ever have any chance of success? And that was a question that really bugged me, because it's a very different interpretation. If you say, well, the slaves never had a chance of success, then you sort of look at the leaders and you say, well, these men weren't sophisticated, they were crazy. And that's the conclusion a lot of people have drawn about other slave revolts. You can look at the descriptions of Nat Turner. Many historians have sort of said, oh, he's crazy because he never had a chance. So he must have been sort of a lunatic prophet. So when I was looking at this revolt, I was desperate for some answer, and I was so shocked when I came upon this letter from Commodore John Shaw, who's the naval commander there in New Orleans. And Commodore John Shaw writes that there are, at this time, a mere 40 regular troops in New Orleans, who he calls a weak detachment, and he said that fear and dismay prevailed throughout the city. He said scarcely a single person in the city had for his protection a musket or a cutlass. So they are as a defenseless city guarded by a mere 40 regular troops. And that was a revelation to me, because I said, here's the proof. Here's the proof that the slaves could have succeeded, that this was not a crazed gambit. And in fact, when you put the numbers out like that, really just lay them on a page, 40 regular troops protecting a defenseless and unarmed city versus 200 to 500 slaves who know that if they lose, they'll be tortured, dismembered, decapitated, and their families forced to stay in slavery until they die. So at that moment, I realized that this was not a crazed gambit. This was a serious revolt, a serious rebellion that had a real chance of success.
All right, Dan. Well, thank you very much. And thank you very much for a really important book.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been wonderful to talk to you.
Yeah, you too, man. If you're just joining us, we've been talking with Dan Rasmussen, the author of the New York Times best-selling book, American Uprising, The Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue with our theme this week. And we're going to be listening to an excerpt from a talk by Bob Avakian. Now, the subject of this talk is going to be American democracy, white supremacy, and slavery. Yep, the slavery that ran underneath and stood behind American democracy when this country was first formed and continues to shape it all the way up to today. So stay tuned. Welcome back. This is the Michael Slate Show, and that was Slave Song from David Murray. Continuing with our theme today, I wanted you to have a chance to listen to an excerpt from a talk by Bob Avakian called Communism and Jeffersonian Democracy. You know, I put a lot of thought into where we could go with this second segment of today's show, keeping in line with the theme. And I decided that we need to keep on digging for some truth on this issue. I started the show off with a quote from Avakian that was drawn from the book Basics. It's the quote that opens up the book Basics. And that quote said, "There would be no United States as we now know it today without slavery. That is a simple and basic truth." Simple, basic, and true. But think how controversial this is. We live in a country built on and sustained by lies and distortions. At best, we're told that slavery was an unfortunate stain on the sacred democratic fabric of this country. We're told to pay more attention to that hero of equality, freedom, and democracy for all, Thomas Jefferson, than to the slaveocracy that this country was built on and that continues to influence it today. We're told to disregard the cranks who place too much emphasis on the past, to just get over slavery. And more commonly these days, our schools are even teaching children that the Civil War was not about slavery, but about states' rights. Well, I hope this excerpt from Avakian's talk, Communism and Jeffersonian Democracy, can bang a few holes in all that. So let's take a listen.
In reality, Jefferson's agrarian society turned out to be a society based on slavery and ruled by slave owners. One striking example that a number of people have pointed to in this regard is the Louisiana Purchase. Napoleon, having suffered some military defeats, reckoned that he couldn't easily hold on to these territory that was became part of the Louisiana Purchase by the U.S. under Jefferson. And so Jefferson stepped in to quickly grab up this territory, to purchase it. And he did so primarily in the interest of the slave owners and in order to spread the slave-owning system into those new territories, not to develop an agrarian society based on a multitude of small, yeoman, independent farmers. And this is just one example of many that are spoken to in some of those books that I referred to of how Jefferson consistently acted not in the interest of these yeoman small farmers, but in the interest of the slave-owning class, even as not only as against the yeomen, but also their interests in conflict with those of the rising capitalist class in the North. Along with the economic dimension, the whole Southern way of life was one that depended on slavery. That was its fundamental economic basis. Even small landowners who didn't own slaves strived to get into a position to own some. And in a more personal dimension, Jefferson's political fortunes, including his election to the presidency itself, depended on slavery. And in particular, as I've spoken to elsewhere, the three-fifths provision in the Constitution, the so-called three-fifths compromise that said that slaves, for the purposes both of taxation but also of election and representation, would be counted as three-fifths of people. And as many Northerners pointed out at the time, coming from various positions and with various motives, this essentially allowed the Southern states to, by the ownership of property in the form of slaves, accumulate a lot of more votes or representation in the government by the multiplication of this property, which, of course, Northern owners of property, for example, farms or small factories, didn't get to count each factory in terms of how much representation the state would have. But the slave states got to count three-fifths of each of the slave, the total of each all the slaves, in terms of representation in the government. So this tilted things toward the Southern states in terms of the political structure from the beginning of the country. And in fact, if you look into this, you'll see that this was something that the Southern states insisted upon, or there would have been no union. There would have been no United States. And even those in the North who, on basis of moral conviction and or economic interest, were opposed to slavery, ended up capitulating to this, because otherwise the South would have refused to join in the Union and there would have been no United States, regardless of the war against England and the Declaration of Independence and all that. When it came down to it, this was a sine qua non. This was an absolute requirement for the slave-owning class in the South. And it did involve a compromise, but this compromise embodied the things that I've been speaking to, which gave a certain disproportionate power to the South, to the slave-owning class, and which enabled them to block and counter moves that would have gone in the direction of abolishing slavery. Sometimes it's claimed by, in fact, it's claimed quite often by different people that Jefferson was actually opposed to slavery and wanted to see an end to it. And you can find statements by Jefferson where he says that slavery is, in fact, a blight and that it will have the consequences down the road and so on, of a negative kind down the road and so on. And also, there have been misinterpretations of what Jefferson wrote about slavery, some of which didn't get into the final version of the Declaration of Independence, where he denounced in strong terms the, some of it did get in and some of it didn't, but denunciation in strong terms of the King of England and the of the British government for supposedly imposing the slave trade on the United States. And there were ways in which Jefferson and the Virginia slave-owning class in particular were opposed to aspects of the slave trade, that is, the international slave trade, because they themselves were involved in selling slaves to other states and slave owners in other territories. And they didn't want the price of a slave being driven down. And this is the reason fundamentally that they were opposed to the continuation, once they did oppose it, of the international slave trade. They view this entirely in property and supply and demand terms. So in reality, once again on this point, Jefferson acted in the interest of the slave-owning class, and his agrarian society turned out to be a slave-owning plantation society in reality, not a society of small, independent farming yeomen. Now, this is, of course, related to, in an overall sense, part of the larger contradiction between Jefferson's lofty-sounding statements in the Declaration of Independence about the equality of all men, note all men, and their inalienable rights, and on the other hand, the glaring fact that Jefferson not only owned slaves himself, but, as I've pointed to, consistently acted on behalf of the class of slave owners and in upholding the institution of slavery, even while voicing certain moral qualms and objections to slavery, and recognizing that it strategically embodied many problems and dangers for the new American Republic. This, again, was a very acute contradiction.
A quick reminder, you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're listening to an excerpt from Bob Avakian's talk, Communism and Jeffersonian Democracy. The subject of this excerpt is built around how Jefferson's ideal society was a reality of slavery and everything that brings with it.
Historian Edward S. Morgan, in American Slavery, American Freedom, which is cited in David Bryan Davis's book, In Human Bondage, argues that for Jefferson and other Virginian slave owners, such as George Washington and James Madison, the latter being the principal author of the U.S. Constitution, and also Madison himself became president of the United States, for figures like this, there was a certain kind of unity, a unity of opposites, as we would say, between how they viewed whites and, on the other hand, black Africans, mulattoes, and Indians. And I'm going to quote from Morgan and give a little explanation of what he's saying here to make it a little clearer. Morgan says, quote, "Racism thus absorbed in Virginia the fear and contempt that men of the upper classes in Europe, whether Whig or Tory," that is, today we would say whether liberal or conservative, "felt for the inarticulate lower classes of whites or Europeans." In other words, he's saying here that this, in Europe, there was an open contempt on the part of the upper ruling classes and their political representatives for the inarticulate and ignorant rabble of the lower classes. But in the United States, the same thing did not find exactly the same expression, because a lot of this contempt was, if you want to put it that way, deflected and directed toward the masses of black people who were enslaved, and to, you know, overwhelmingly, especially in the South, and toward mulattoes and Indians. And then Morgan goes on. Racism made it possible for white Virginians to develop, and this is very significant in terms of the whole development of bourgeois democracy in this country. Racism made it possible for white Virginians to develop a devotion to liberty, for whites we should underline, that English Republicans had declared to be the soul of liberty. In other words, because of racism and because of excluding, essentially, from consideration as human beings deserving of freedom, of classes or groups of people such as Africans, mulattoes, and Indians, they could, at the same time, without feeling an acute contradiction, articulate, as Jefferson did in the Declaration of Independence, lofty principles of the equality of and inalienable rights of all people. They were speaking about all white people, and more specifically, all white men, dead or otherwise. And they were explicitly excluding from this these other groups of people that I've referred to, most especially the African people of African origin. And so the one went together with the other. They could feel, in large part exactly because of this exclusion, that they were speaking in a universal way about freedom, even while they represented certain particular interests, certain particular class interests, even among the whites. There was a dialectical unity there. By excluding these other groups, they could feel, even while they represented the interests of the ruling classes among whites, they could feel they were speaking in universal terms about the freedoms for all people who were not excluded, i.e. the whites. This is a very important insight. And then he goes on. He speaks about Republicans, and he doesn't mean the ruling right-wing party in the U.S. today, but people who have a Republican philosophy of government. That is to say, the general political philosophical viewpoint that is opposed, for example, to a monarchy, the best and most just form of government is a republic in which the people are said to be sovereign and have the formal right to vote and elect representatives to government in whatever form that takes place. So these people, in other words, could proclaim republican principles and believe in them even while practicing and defending slavery, as well as other forms of exploitation. And Morgan goes on, by lumping Indians, mulattoes, and Negroes in a single pariah class, that is, putting them in a category of people who were not really to be considered human in terms of the rights and freedoms that human beings should have. By lumping Indians, mulattoes, and Negroes in a single pariah class, Virginians, and here he's speaking about ruling class slave-owning Virginians in particular, Virginians had paved the way for a similar lumping of small and large planters in a single master class. Here again you see the unity between the exclusion of one and the notion of unity of all the others, even with the class divisions among them. And Morgan continues, racism became an essential, if unacknowledged, ingredient of the Republican ideology that enabled Virginians, like Jefferson and Madison, as well as Washington, to lead the nation. And this is a peculiarity or particularity of the development of bourgeois society and the principles of bourgeois democracy as they developed from the very beginning and have evolved historically in the United States. As David Bryan Davis summed it up in his recent book on slavery, In Human Bondage, quote, according to Morgan, racial slavery enabled Virginia's slave-owning planter class to co-opt the poorer whites and thus perpetuate a highly exploitative and unequal society under the banner of Republican liberty. And this is something very important to understand, not only in terms of the history of the founding of the country and the basis on which it was founded, but in terms of its implications and in terms of its consequences down through the history of the country, even to today. So with whatever limitations there may be in Morgan's and in Davis's overall analysis, there is definitely important truth to the fact that, first of all, the Republican ideology and notions of freedom that have characterized the way in which the United States has been conceived and ruled have indeed included racism and the oppression of black people and others whom today are often called people of color, the exclusion of them from the very beginning, from this notion of freedom, and their oppression from the very beginning and in the very foundation of the country. And there has been a definite tendency for this to contribute in various ways to blunting the overall class conflicts in society and the class consciousness of the proletarians, among the whites in particular, but also in a different way among black people and other oppressed nationalities. So all that's by way of speaking to the first irony that I mentioned, that Jefferson talked about a virtuous yeoman-based agrarian society, but actually in opposition to that, consistently upheld and fought for the interests of the slave-owning class and the agrarian society that in reality he was an embodiment and a spokesperson for, was a slave-owning plantation society.
All right. Once again, that was Bob Avakian talking about slavery, white supremacy, and democracy in America. And that was taken from his talk, Communism and Jeffersonian Democracy. Okay, and this talk is part of 7 talks that Avakian gave a number of years back. And those talks were just mind-blowing. It included this one on Jeffersonian democracy, but also 6 other talks on all the aspects of the world today, the way it's savaged by capitalism, imperialism, how that's manifest, why it got that way, and what we can do about it, and what a new society could look like. Check this out. You're not going to want to miss it. All right. So you can actually access all that by going to revcom.us. That's revcom.us. And when you go there, you'll see links to all the various talks and other works by Avakian, and it will blow your mind. I guarantee that. So don't hesitate to go there. I want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm the host and producer of the show, Michael Slate. We're going to go out now with Freedom Day from the album We Insist, Freedom Now Sweet, by Max Roach, and featuring the work of Abby Lincoln and Oscar Brown Jr., among others. Talk to you again next week.
Lying, can it really be? Can't conceive it, can't believe it, but that's what they say. Slave no longer, this is Freedom Day. Freedom Day, it's Freedom Day. Throw those shackling chains away.